This is VOA News. I'm Marissa Melton. The White House says U.S. President Joe Biden will meet virtually on Friday with G7 leaders and Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky to mark the one-year anniversary of Russia's invasion of Ukraine and announce new sanctions against those aiding Russia's war effort. The same group came together and imposed sanctions on Russia last year, just hours after Russian President Vladimir Putin launched his invasion of Ukraine. White House spokesperson Karine Jean-Pierre told reporters Thursday that the leaders on Friday will discuss how to continue supporting Ukraine and how to increase pressure on Russia to end its aggression. Jean-Pierre said the new sanctions will include Russian banks, technology and defense sectors, and will impact both people and companies involved in the conflict. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky said in a video address Thursday that pro-Moscow forces had again shelled the southern city of Kherson, this time cutting off heat for 40,000 people. He said the situation is quite dangerous in some places in the south, while in the east, it is very difficult and even painful. Zelensky said repair work in Kherson, which is being shelled on a daily basis, would continue until heat was restored. And Russia on Thursday claimed Ukraine is ramping up efforts to invade Transnistria, Moldova's Moscow-backed separatist region. Russia pledged a response. Since the launch of the full-scale assault against Ukraine a year ago, the Kremlin has been accused of raising tensions in Transnistria to destabilize Russia, Ukraine and Moldova. But the Russian defense ministry released a statement Thursday saying Kyiv is the one stirring up trouble. Russia claimed that Ukrainian troops are massing at the border with Moldova's breakaway region. This is VOA News. Iran, for the first time, has directly acknowledged an accusation that it enriched uranium to 84% purity. AP correspondent Karen Chamas has more.
The Islamic Republic recognized the claim made by international inspectors that it had enriched uranium to 84%. Such a high percentage would put the nation more than ever to weapons-grade material. The acknowledgement was made by a news website linked to the highest reaches of Iran's theocracy. The latest development renews pressure on the West to address Tehran's nuclear program, which had been contained by the 2015 nuclear deal that America unilaterally withdrew from in 2018. I'm Karen Chamas.
Northern Irish police have arrested a fourth man early on Friday in relation to the attempted murder of a senior detective shot in front of his son in the town of Omagh. Northern Ireland Police Chief Simon Byrne said Thursday that three men had been arrested following the shooting of the senior detective. Detective Chief Inspector John Caldwell is in critical condition, having undergone surgery overnight. He was shot a number of times by two gunmen while putting footballs in his car after finishing a coaching session with an under-15 soccer team. U.S. State Department spokesman Ned Price addressed the issue on Thursday.
Our thoughts are with the family, friends, and colleagues of the officer at this time. We'll continue to be in touch with our colleagues and our counterparts on this.
While a 1988 peace deal largely ended three decades of sectarian violence in Northern Ireland, police officers are still sporadically targeted by splinter groups of mostly Irish nationalist militants opposed to Britain's rule over the region. A federal judge has handed singer R. Kelly a 20-year prison sentence for his Chicago convictions of child pornography and the enticement of minors for sex. In a victory for Kelly, the court said Thursday he will serve 19 years of that sentence simultaneously with his 30-year sentence imposed last year in New York. Only 1 year of prison time for the Chicago convictions will follow the New York term. Prosecutors have requested that the 56-year-old Kelly serve the full Chicago sentence after he completed the New York term. Harvey Weinstein, the once powerful Hollywood producer who was brought down by multiple allegations of sexual misconduct, was sentenced on Thursday to 16 years in prison for the 2013 rape of an actress. Weinstein will serve the sentence after completing a 23-year sentence for sexual misconduct in New York. And Paris lit up the Eiffel Tower in the blue and yellow colors of the Ukrainian flag on Thursday as Ukraine's allies around the world prepare to mark the one-year anniversary of the war between Ukraine and Russia. Marissa Melton, VOA News.
Today is Friday, February 24th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, the UN calls for the withdrawal of Russian forces from Ukraine as the war reaches a grim one-year milestone.
The result of the vote is as follows. In favor, 141. Against, 7. Abstentions, 32. Draft resolution A/ES11/L7 is adopted.
Tensions continue in Gaza as militants fire rockets and Israel carries out airstrikes.
Tensions flared there, as well as fears of a broader escalation, a day after an Israeli raid on Nablus in the occupied West Bank killed 11 Palestinians and wounded more than 100.
And in Nigerian police expresses readiness to protect voters and votes in Saturday's pivotal presidential election. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. The UN General Assembly has passed a non-binding resolution that calls for Russia to end hostilities and withdraw from its neighbor on the eve of the first anniversary of Moscow's invasion. The resolution, which passed Thursday on a vote of 141-7 with 32 abstentions, sent a strong message that Russia's aggression must end, foreign ministers from more than a dozen European nations and Japan, during 2 days of debate, called for support of a resolution that upholds Ukraine's territorial integrity. The U.S. Congress has appropriated more than $112 billion in aid to Ukraine since Russia's invasion 1 year ago. VOA's congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson looks back at the scope of that assistance and reports on what happens next.
A promise from the Ukrainian president to the U.S. Congress last December.
Your money is not charity. It's an investment in the global security and democracy that we handle in the most responsible way.
U.S. President Joe Biden pledged an additional $500 million in aid as he marked the one-year anniversary of the invasion, saying support for Ukraine would not waver.
All across my country, in big cities and small towns, Ukrainian flags fly from American homes. Over the past year, Democrats and Republicans in our United States Congress have come together to stand for freedom.
U.S. lawmakers' response in the first days of the invasion was swift, with overall broad support for assistance most say is key to American security. Republican Senator James Risch.
The United States and our allies around the world quickly came to a consensus that we need to support Ukraine's defense of its people, territory, and way of life from Russian aggression.
Congress would ultimately send the largest aid package for a foreign conflict since the U.S. war in Iraq. Georgetown University's Matt Glassman.
We had the situation where the administration was asking for not a trivial sum of money, and many people in the Hill, bipartisan, wanted them to go further and provide more offensive and powerful weapons to Ukraine. And so that's sort of unusual in American history. Typically, presidents are on the leading edge of these sorts of international conflict.
But a year on, public support in the U.S. appears to be softening. According to a February 2023 Associated Press poll, 48% of Americans favor sending weapons, down from 60% who favored the move in a May poll of last year. Congressional support for Ukraine is still strong, but there is growing disagreement about how much aid to send and for how long. Republican Representative Ryan Zinke.
What's the plan? To suggest that it's just open-ended, a blank check in Ukraine. Now, remember, when we ship armament to Ukraine, we don't control where their armament's going because we've given them a blank check. I don't like blank checks.
Ukraine has made moves to address concerns about internal corruption, and U.S. lawmakers say they're satisfied with the results they've seen on firsthand visits. Republican Senator Lindsey Graham.
We're very reassured that our military assistance is going to where it should be going to, and their accountability and transparency is there.
Leading foreign policy voices in the Senate say the outcome of the war in Ukraine will have consequences for U.S. policy for decades. Democratic Senator Robert Menendez.
what is at stake is not only the Ukrainians' freedom, which in and of itself is important, but also the proposition that you cannot by force take another country's territory. Because if that can become the rule of the day, there are many despots and authoritarians who will seek to do that.
With no clear end to the conflict in sight, the U.S. Congress is expected to debate additional aid in the coming months. Catherine Gibson, VOA News, Capitol Hill.
And as Russian tanks rolled into eastern Ukraine a year ago, millions of Ukrainians fled to Poland. Many came by foot through the Medica border crossing, where aid agencies mounted a huge emergency response. 12 months on, viewers Henry Ridgewell returned to Medica to see what has changed and how authorities are preparing for a possible new wave of refugees.
Daniil's short life has been turned upside down by Russia's invasion. He and his mother, Julia, fled Kiev a year ago. They stayed in Dnipro, but were forced to flee again as the city came under attack and have just arrived at the Polish border town of Medica. Now they have a new plan. Julia's new partner is a truck driver. They will live with him in the truck as he drives around Europe.
It's not so bad because it's very warm and we have light, electricity, and it's very interesting for my son. I have 3 years old son, and it's not so bad. It's really safety for us.
Polina Osadcha helps look after Daniil. Osadcha is a refugee who now works for the United Nations at this reception center at the Medica border crossing. She says Ukrainians are adapting to the war.
They already, even when there was these problems with blackouts, for the first time all the people were stressed, shocked what to do, but now they have generators, they have power banks.
Britain's Mo Hornick and Mikey Stewart Richardson are from the MAD Foundation charity, which takes aid into Ukraine and refugees back to Britain. But today they have a feline passenger. Mo Hornick explains.
This little guy's owner has been living in the UK for a little while and was really desperate to be reunited with his mum. So we have helped organise some transport. It's more important than ever, almost, that people are remain aware of the situation in Ukraine. I think a lot of people may feel a little bit fatigued by the news that they see, but the situation is still very, very desperate.
At the Medica crossing, much has changed in a year. At the start of Russia's invasion, up to 30,000 refugees poured across this frontier every day. Now only a few hundred cross the border daily. Soup kitchens have been replaced with cell phone stalls. Buses quickly take the Ukrainians away from the border. The mayor of Przemyśl City, a few kilometres from the frontier, recalls the chaos of a year ago. Wojtek Bakun, the mayor of Przemyśl City, a few kilometres from the frontier, recalls the chaos of a year ago.
40% of all refugees from Ukraine crossing the city of Przemyśl. So it's a huge amount of people crossing such a small city. A lot of them was very hungry, thirsty, you know, some of them need some medical assistance, medical help.
A former supermarket in Przemyśl has been turned into a humanitarian hub. The warehouse stores huge volumes of food and drink, medical supplies, beds and blankets. There are fears that a renewed Russian offensive will create a new wave of refugees. Again, Mayor Wojtek Bakun.
We have all that logistics system ready to expand. We have still a lot of beds stored in schools, things like that. So we're ready for that situation again. But hopefully that situation will not happen again.
Russia's invasion brought millions of refugees to Poland and large-scale land warfare to NATO's doorstep. 12 months on, with little sign of an end to the conflict, all sides are preparing for a long war. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News on the Poland-Ukraine border.
Today, on the one-year anniversary of Russia's invasion of Ukraine, some humanitarian groups working to stave off acute hunger in Africa say they have faced big funding shortfalls, partly because those funds have been diverted to Ukraine. Tom Paracosta is the spokesperson for the Norwegian Refugee Council in Central and West Africa. He tells VOA's Carol Van Damme many countries on the continent were directly impacted by the war in Ukraine when Ukrainian shipments of grain and fertilizer were cut off by the Russians this past year.
It's important to remember that most of African countries, especially in West and Central Africa, endure a crisis. Most of the food comes from farming and harvest, and this has been impacted heavily when the prices of cereals and fertilizers went up, and we've seen a sharp rise of people being food insecure, and we still expect the situation to be worsening in 2023. Just to give you an example, by the period of the lean season, which should be between May and August, we accept 48 million people to be food insecure in Mali, Burkina Faso, Central African Republic, and Nigeria. And this is partly due to the war in Ukraine.
The food insecurity that we're hearing about in Somalia and the countries you mentioned, it's supposed to be the worst in decades. Is there a direct correlation, would you say, between the war in Ukraine and what's happening in Africa with food insecurity?
It exacerbates. It's not the only reason. Obviously, the main reasons are widespread conflicts, climate change. But of course, the war in Ukraine is worsening the situation. And it's also worsening our ability as humanitarians to support people who are food insecure. Just to give you a concrete example, in the Central African Republic this year, due to a big shortage of fuel, we had to suspend our operations in some part of Central African Republic, which affected 3.1 million people, basically. 3.1 million people were already suffering in a critical situation, and we could not reach part of them due to a critical lack of fuel. What's striking is that years after years, we say this is the worst year in the region in terms of food insecurity, but everywhere it's getting worse. We don't know when it's going to end, really, because every year we have additional burdens on the region. And you have to add to that the fact that this region is heavily neglected. The West and Central African region, especially, is really neglected by the international community compared to other regions in crisis.
That's Tom Per Costa, spokesperson for the Norwegian Refugee Council in Central and West Africa. He was speaking with my colleague Carol Van Damme from Senegal. Gaza militants fired rockets and Israel carried out airstrikes in a cross-border exchange on Thursday, the day after 11 Palestinians were killed during an Israeli raid in the occupied West Bank. The flare-up has renewed concerns of a broader escalation. Lucy Fielder of Reuters has more.
Smoke rises over Gaza after an Israeli strike on Thursday morning. Tensions flared there, as well as fears of a broader escalation. A day after an Israeli raid on Nablus in the occupied West Bank killed 11 Palestinians and wounded more than 100. Palestinians went on strike across the West Bank, East Jerusalem and Gaza on Thursday. Schools, universities, shops and banks closed their doors. Mahfiz Sidda lives in Hebron.
It is a day of mourning and a strike. How could we work or eat or drink while our brothers in Nablus are being killed? We had to stand in solidarity with them, with the people of Nablus. There had to be a general strike in the whole West Bank and Gaza, and thank God there is.
Israel's military said six rockets were fired from Gaza, setting off air raid sirens in southern Israel. Five were intercepted and no injuries were reported. Israeli fighter jets later struck a weapons manufacturing site belonging to Hamas, the Islamist group that controls Gaza, the Israeli military said. There were no known injuries. Israeli forces video shows the Nablus raid. Soldiers firing on a house where they said militants were hiding. Six gunmen and five civilians were killed, Palestinian sources said. Egypt and the United Nations were mediating on Thursday to calm the situation, as UN Middle East envoy Tor Wennesland arrived in Gaza to meet Hamas leaders. The Palestinian militant faction Islamic Jihad stopped short of claiming it fired the rockets from Gaza, but said it had the right to defend against Israeli aggression. Leaders from Hamas and Islamic Jihad warned mediators that the situation could slide into an open confrontation if there was no change, according to a Palestinian official. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's office declined to comment.
That's Lucy Fielder of Reuters. In other news, Turkey Interior Minister Süleyman Soylu has raised the number of fatalities from the magnitude 7.8 earthquake to 43,556. The combined death toll in Turkey and Syria now stands at 47,000, 244. In northwestern Syria, this local civil defense, known locally as the White Helmets, said thousands of children and tens of thousands of families have taken shelter in cars and tents, fearing they will face a repeat of the earthquake. In government-held Syria, a first plane for Bahrain, loaded with aid, landed in Damascus. This is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington. The Nigerian police force is calling on voters to be respectful of officials of the Independent National Electoral Commission tasked with administering the elections. This after announcing the deployment of police personnel across the country in preparation for the presidential, senatorial, and House of Representatives elections, as well as the gubernatorial elections in 2 weeks. VOA's Peter Klote, on a special assignment to the Nigerian elections, spoke with Adeleke B. Adeyinka. He's the Deputy Inspector General of Police, Department of Operations of the Nigerian Police Service.
There's going to be restriction of movement on the day of the election to protect our people. The way we have planned it, corridors leading into the election area, into cities, into states, will be manned by armed men, most especially the Nigerian Army. While on the election itself, we are going to ensure that each polling booth in Nigeria.
During the election period itself, both the presidential and the gubernatorial, senatorial and all, what will the police want to see and what will the police not want to see during the election
period? That is from the people.
Yes.
I only appeal to our citizens that we should abide by the electoral laws. We should respect our INEC officials. Because basically our own duty on election day, while providing security, is to ensure that INEC facilities are protected, INEC officials are protected, our polling areas are protected. So people should come out and exercise their franchise. We should be peaceful, we should be law-abiding. If there is any restriction order for that particular day, we should abide by it, get accredited, vote, go home. And at the same time, let me add, part of the election itself is the aftermath of the election. When we want to rejoice, let's rejoice peacefully. When we want to mourn our losses, let's mourn peacefully. Then we have a good election.
What about the professionalism of the police force or personnel who will be deployed during this election period, especially in the polling stations? Because sometimes, I'm sure you've heard reports, people said, oh, well, they feel intimidated, they feel harassed. What assurances are you giving these voters that the police will remain professional, they will be protected during this election period?
Prior to this period, we've had sensitization programs for our policemen. We've been trained by INEC, we've been trained by NGOs, we've been trained by international bodies. We've trained ourselves, all the men that we are sending out for these election duties. I'm assuring you and I'm assuring Nigerians that they're going to be professional. They're going to act professionally. I'm speaking on behalf of the entire security agencies that are going to assist us in taking part in this election.
That's Adeleke B. Adeyinka, Deputy Inspector General of Police, Department of Operations of the Nigerian Police Force. He was speaking with VOA's Peter Klote. Joe Biden made the first visit by a U.S. First Lady to the southwestern African nation of Namibia, chosen, she said, because of its vibrant democracy. The nation's president and First Lady warmly welcomed her, as Biden, who has visited Africa several times before, began a five-day, two-nation trip to the continent. VOA's Anita Powell reports from the capital, Windhoek.
When asked why she chose Namibia, an arid, sparsely populated southern African nation, as the first stop on what the White House says is a show of support and respect for Africa, First Lady Jill Biden did not hesitate.
We wanted to come because this is a young democracy, and we want to support democracies around the world. And we met each other in December, and we're just continuing the relationship. And Monica and I think it's safe to say that we became good friends instantly.
That friend, Namibian First Lady Monica Geingos, agreed.
Madam First Lady, what do you hope to show Dr. Biden on her trip here? What's important to you?
There's a lot in Namibia that we'd really like to show Dr. Biden. I know it's her first visit to Namibia. I know it's the first time an incumbent American First Lady has come to the country. And I think what she talked about is very true. It is a very vibrant democracy. We've got a very large youth population who drives that democracy very energetically, and it's fully enabled by our constitutional values, but also by the personal values of our leadership. He may not look it, but he's really the ultimate Democrat.
Biden is the first White House official to visit the country after President Joe Biden last year pledged to send administration officials to the continent. She follows Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen and U.S. Ambassador to the U.N. Linda Thomas-Greenfield, who made trips to Africa earlier this year. Thomas-Greenfield focused part of her visit around the food security crisis in East Africa, something Biden plans to highlight when she visits Kenya later this week. But these high-profile visits are also happening against the background of increased visits by top-level Russian and Chinese officials to the continent. Anita Powell, VOA News, Windhoek, Namibia.
This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours at voanews.com and check out VOA Africa for more English language programming. You can find International Edition on our current affairs program, Encounter, Press Conference USA and Issues in the News on voanews.com. Until next time, I am Chinedu Afo in Washington. Have a great weekend.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
To hinder Vladimir Putin's ability to wage war against Ukraine, the United States and its partners last year imposed crippling new sanctions on Russia's military-industrial complex and tightened those that were introduced after Russia's invasion of Crimea in 2014. As Russia lost access to key components necessary for the operations of its more sophisticated weapon systems, it began to look for other ways to acquire them. On February 1st, the U.S. Treasury Department's Office of Foreign Assets Control, or OFAC, imposed sanctions pursuant to Executive Order 14024 on 22 individuals and entities around the world for their connection to a global sanctions evasion network supporting Russia's military-industrial complex. Russia and Cyprus-based arms dealer Igor Vladimirovich Zamyankov leads the network. Its members have procured materials for and supported key parts of Russia's military-industrial complex, including state-owned Russian defense entities like Rosoboron Export OAO and state corporations Rostec. OFAC has previously sanctioned both of these entities. Igor Zamyankov and his son Yonatan Zamyankov have worked with numerous individuals and entities to enable Russian defense sales to third country governments, thus helping to finance the network. Igor and Yonatan Zamyankov were designated pursuant to Executive Order 14024 for operating or having operated in the defense and related materiel sector of the Russian Federation economy, and Yonatan Zamyankov for having materially assisted and supported Igor Zamyankov. Also designated were the Singapore-based Zamyankov Network Shell Company, Asia Trading and Construction Pte. Limited, and its director, Serena B. Lin Ng, and Texel FCG Technology 2100 Limited, and its chief operating officer, Mark Splatz, as well as Electro-Optica SIA, which Splatz owns. Alexander Volfovich, a Cyprus-based arms broker, was sanctioned for being an owner and director of GBD Limited and the public registered owner of six other companies in the Zamyankov network. Also designated under Executive Order 14024 were Stanislav Volfovich and Ariel Volfovich, Max Borosovich Piflox and his son Gilad Piflox, Igor Polnichenko and Polnichenko's two companies, Pisaron Limited and Terra Az Limited. Russia's desperate attempts to utilize proxies to circumvent U.S. sanctions demonstrate that sanctions have made it much harder and costlier for Russia's military-industrial complex to resupply Putin's war machine, said Deputy Secretary of the Treasury Wally Adeyemo. Targeting proxies is one of many steps that Treasury and our coalition of partners have taken and continue to take to tighten sanctions enforcement against Russia's defense sector, its benefactors, and its supporters.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.